Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, please press star two. Your first question comes from the line of Jeffrey Sprague with Vertica.
Good morning, everyone.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Jeff, you perhaps created a little bit of a brouhaha, perhaps unintentionally, and things got maybe a little blown out in the press a couple weeks ago with your comments on China. But I'm wondering if you could give us just a, you know, a little bit of additional perspective on, you know, perhaps how you see the market transitioning. I mean, clearly there's probably an intensifying competitive dynamic starting to take form as the market's not all just about Western companies tapping the demand there, but maybe the growth and ultimate resurgence of some of these Chinese companies. Just give us some thoughts on how you navigate that landscape and any thoughts on maybe how you might change how you approach business, kind of the JV structure or other dynamics?
You know, Jeff, I'm going to limit the dinners I have in Italy from now on. I can tell you that much. But I showed a chart at EPG on China, which I think really reflects our perspective, which is it's an extremely big and strategic market. We've got a big footprint of about $6 billion, and you know, we plan to grow at double digits. That our strategy will be multifaceted. We'll have businesses that will completely grow, you know, in a significant way, like healthcare. We'll have healthcare and aviation. We'll have opportunities to do joint ventures with state-owned enterprises like the one we introduced this week with Avionyx, with AVIC, which I think gives us a chance to leapfrog some of our competitors. And there's going to be places where we have competitors there in the energy business and in the rail business. But when you add them all up, I still view China as an immensely strategic market for GE, one that we're doing well in, one that we'll continue to grow in, and one where we'll have strategic opportunities from a cost and a business model standpoint as we look forward in the future.
And then just for, well, actually maybe for Keith, but for either, there was a mention on supply constraints in one of the businesses, I think healthcare. Is that actually impacting revenues in any of your businesses? And what impact is it having on the organization overall?
You know, Jeff, I'll start, and Keith, you can amplify it. But you know, anybody in the electronic supply chain has seen a tightness around certain components. Healthcare for us is the biggest consumer of electronics. And as you can see, the difference between orders in the last two quarters, really three quarters, and revenue, we're building a lot of backlog. You know, all of us are getting better on the supply chain. And I think particularly in healthcare, that just makes it should give us a little bit of juice for the second half of the year, is the way I'd look at it. And that's really, I think, other than healthcare, Keith, we're not really.
Healthcare is the only place we've really seen it, and we've seen it for a while. I think we're talking about around $50 million of revenue that maybe got hung up at the end of the quarter in the supply chain. But the teams have been working it for a couple of quarters. I think they're really working through it, and it's not going to have an impact on us.
Just one final one, if I could squeeze one more in. You mentioned energy price being positive in revenues, but I think we've had a couple quarters here now where price and orders has been negative. And I'm just wondering if there's a kind of a visible inflection out there where, you know, you're really booking negative price through the energy business.
I think if you look at the total in energy, it's down a little bit. Thermal down one. Wind, you know, on not a huge number of turbines, was down eight. I think you're going to probably continue to see price pressure in the wind area. I think you're going to see pressure in the renewables area in total. But I think the thermal business is a little more stable. I mean, we aren't really dealing with huge volumes of growth or huge declines in volumes. You know, it's kind of about stable at the 110, 115 kind of gas turbines a year level.
And what I would say, Jeff, is that this team is generating about 4% deflation this year, the sourcing team. So we've got, you know, I actually expect the value gap for energy to be, you know, okay as you look forward in the future.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right, Jeff.
Your next question comes from the line of Julian Mitchell from Credit Suisse.
Yes, thanks. I had two questions, please. The first one on healthcare. Obviously, that's a business where you had kind of three consecutive years of falling earnings. You've had decent earnings growth in the first half so far. Could you maybe give an update on the restructuring in healthcare and also on the pricing? And then secondly, within the energy business, just what you're seeing in terms of large tendering activity at the major utilities globally in terms of thermal as well as wind equipment. Obviously, you know, large thermal orders have been fairly dormant for 2 years now. How quickly do you think those might pick up?
Why don't I take a crack?
Yeah, go on.
Keith, you can fill in. Look, I think, you know, healthcare, we had a tough couple of years, so all of us are a little bit hesitant to be super bullish. I think there's a couple of things I like about the business right now. One is a lot of the regulatory impact is now known and being reflected, so I think that's good. There's strong pent-up demand among our customers for technology. Our product line is very strong right now in healthcare, so I see good interest from top to bottom. Our emerging market growth is very strong. Our China and India businesses all grew in excess of 25% in the quarter. And the team's doing a good job in execution, margin rates, working capital, things like that. So I see some positives as we look at healthcare going forward that I don't think are just one-time type items. I think they're just strong, fundamental, underlying dynamics, as well as us doing okay in the business. In energy, most of the activity in the second quarter of orders came outside the United States, a lot in the Middle East and Latin America and Asia. And so I think it's, other than the Middle East, they're not super huge tenders, but they're, you know, a couple gas turbines at a time. And, you know, we've got a big sales force that can accommodate that. And I think the U.S. has been still sluggish, no worse than it was last year, but no better. And but the interest outside the United States is pretty good, and we see pretty good funnels there. And that's true, you know, our three big wind markets are probably going to be Brazil, Canada, Turkey, places like that. So, Keith, that's my view. I don't know.
Sure, I agree. I think, you know, the healthcare restructuring that we did last year, we probably spent $150 to $200 million in projects that are less than two-year paybacks. And I think the team's doing a great job of executing. And now, you know, they're really focused on growing distribution to be able to take advantage of the growth in the developing world. I think we're continuing to do a little bit of restructuring to help them to combine the diagnostic imaging with the rest of the product line, so we got a cleaner, streamlined structure globally. But you know, the team's delivering. I think you see it in the order rates with new products. You see it in the profitability growth, and you see it in the margin rates.
Great. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Michael Cole from Deutsche Bank.
Thanks. Good morning.
I hope it's Nigel still, isn't it?
It certainly is. I haven't changed my name yet. So, Keith, you gave a good bit of color on the Fed oversight, so what you expect in terms of the regulatory path of the next 12 months or so. What kind of framework are you imagining towards as this policy develops, and maybe specifically, what kind of Tier 1 ratio and leverage ratios are you imagining towards?
Well, I think what we're seeing today is what we know so far. You know, if you look at an 8% Tier 1 ratio and you go back to what the large financial institutions in the U.S. had to do as part of the stress tests and to be able to repay TARP, we feel like that's a very strong level of capital. And if you look at what might have to happen in the future from the new regulatory reform bill or from activity like Basel III, which we think is going to be pushed out and maybe changed a little bit to the benefit of the large financial institutions. Anything that we can foresee here, we'll be able to deal with based on the fact that we continue to shrink the book. You know, when you get down to $440 billion of ending net investment, we aren't anticipating a dividend out of G Capital in 11. We do think that we'll pay a normal dividend somewhere around 45% of their earnings in 2012. But when you get down to those levels of capital, somewhere out in 2013 and 14, I mean, we should have excess capital in our financial services business. and whether, you know, we need it for some really different regulatory level or we can use it to reinvest back in the rest of the company, I think is yet to be seen. But, you know, the outlook for us based on the performance of the business, the shrinkage that we're doing, you know, we're shrinking in very high leverage products, you know, the mortgage business, you know, high leverage. And as that shrinks, that gives us an awful lot of capital flexibility. So, I feel like we're trying to be thoughtful about it and cautious about it. Obviously, the rules are not written. There's no prescriptive number. But for the risks that we take in our business, we feel like we're very strongly capitalized and that whatever's going to come at us, we'll be able to deal with on our own. And we do believe we'll have capital flexibility out later this in the next couple of years.
I think you've said in the past you're driving towards a 10% Tier 1. Is that still the target?
We haven't given a number like that, Nigel. I think, you know, we want to be well capitalized in the regulatory world, and we plan to be that.
Okay, fair enough. A couple of quick ones before I hand it over. First of all, I mean, just following on to Jeff's question, you know, 20% plus, you know, energy margins is pretty spectacular. You've talked about some pricing and pressure in the backlog. You know, I think Jeff mentioned that the value gap remains okay. You know, how do we think about the energy margins as that deflation starts to come through the revenues?
So, you know, what I would say, Nigel, is that the pricing on new engines is still positive, and we expect that to continue. You know, one of the things that I've talked about in the past is has less to do with value gap and margins, and more to do just with funding of growth and strategic funding of the aviation business going forward. You know,
it's mostly on energy right now, but
what's that, Keith?
He's asking about how do we feel about energy going forward.
Oh, are you talking about energy, Nigel?
Yeah, the energy margins in particular.
I thought you said aviation. So, I don't know, Keith.
Yeah, I think if you look at the energy business for us, we're going to basically be dealing with slow equipment growth, as we've said. You know, you saw the equipment revenues are down somewhere around 8%. And the offset to that is the service revenue. And I think the equipment service dynamic in the energy business is going to play out just like it is in some other long cycle places, and overall we're going to be able to have pretty good margins here. You know, 70% of our margins came out of the service business in the second quarter and through the first half, and we built a pretty good install base. We got a lot of units that haven't gone through their major overhaul on the gas turbine fleet. You know, I think the one place you watch is renewables. I think you're just going to have to watch the wind market, but I think the gas turbines market's going to be relatively flat, not very bubbly or dynamic for us, and the service business is what we're going to have to drive growth in. And we're investing a lot in adjacencies. You look at investments in smart grid and investments in everything around energy efficiency. We feel pretty good about some of the growth opportunities
there. And we're seeing good solid deflation as
deflation,
well.
Deflation, as you mentioned, yeah.
And I don't see that slowing down.
And just a quick follow-on there, Keith. You mentioned, you know, a lot of the installed fleet still hasn't had their major overhauls. I mean, when do you expect that inflection point to come through?
Well, we need better energy demand, that's for sure. I think Jeff mentioned it. You know, we dealt with energy demand declines last year for the first time in a long, long time. And I think, you know, we need better utilization. And you saw that the summer, the hot summers helped quite a bit. Low gas prices help. But at the end of the day, we need some global growth. And I don't have a specific time frame for you, Nigel, on that. But I think, you know, that we've got a lot of it under contract. We've got a huge CSA portfolio. And we will continue to benefit from the services growth in the energy space.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Your next question comes from the line of Terry Darling from Goldman Sachs.
Thanks. Good morning. Wanted to talk a little bit about some of the items on the Mosaic slide. You know, in terms of the 11 items you've talked about, you know, in the following chart, the plus up for earnings in 2011, or two pluses, as it were. You know, clearly, it looks like you've got good momentum in GE Capital heading into 11. I'm just trying to think about how all the pluses and the minuses on the industrial side add up as you think about it, and whether we could see industrial earnings down in 11 offset by that strength in capital to get to the overall up, or how you're looking at that right now.
So, you know, Terry, I think we don't give guidance on 11, and we haven't done operating plans and stuff like that. Maybe the easiest thing for me to do is just kind of take you down step by step and give you a sense of each one of the businesses. You know, I think if you take a look at energy, I think what Keith said
just a second ago is probably the most uncertainty is about the wind profile and where that goes. On the plus side, you know, I think we should see some decent orders growth. We've got a good product pipeline, not just in gas turbines, but in places like distributed energy, Yenbacher, things like that. And the adjacencies orders have started to pick up, so we should see some decent momentum and tailwind out of those activities. You know, oil and gas is, you know, everybody's kind of watching what's going on in the Gulf. You know, in the meantime, our orders are quite strong and our backlog's very good. We think there's still potential for our oil and gas business to get even stronger as we go through the year with a very strong profile. Aviation revenue passenger miles are growing. Services we expect will strengthen as we get into next year. We've got big share positions across the board. I think, you know, we will spend, really, if you look at this period of time, you know, I'd say over the last 25 years, we've built a very strong leadership position in commercial aviation. In the next few years, there's going to be investments, not just in the GNX, but in narrow body, business jets, a whole profile and skyline of new technologies. You know, these generate the earnings stream as you look out over the next 25 years. You know, there's probably new planes being built that'll be $500 billion of profit over the next coming year. So we're going to invest more in R&D and product spend over the next couple of years, anywhere from a couple hundred million bucks to as much as $400 or $500 million as we look at the next few years. But that's envisioned in the 11 framework that we give. Healthcare, I think, is more good than bad. You know, healthcare's got, you know, we worry a lot about government budgets and things like that, but reform is better understood. You've got an older installed base. You've got good procedure growth. You've got emerging market growth. You know, as Keith said earlier, we think transportation's hit a low point, and, you know, the backlog is strong. You're going to get some juice out of this business just based on the recovery that you see, you know, going on out there. Home and Business Solutions, you know, retail is a little bit better. Contract's still soft. We've done a good job on cost and margins in this business. We ought to continue to see decent growth. And then we expect pension headwind to be out there in the future. But, you know, that's offset by whatever restructuring we do this year and things like that. So, you know, Terry, when I put it all together, there's a lot of tailwind. But there's some specific things that we're going to manage our way through as we get through 11. But none of those really change kind of the way I feel about the company going forward.
Okay, and then Keith, maybe follow up with you on kind of where we are with the net of restructuring expense and restructuring savings. Sounds like, you know, your first half of the year here, or at least certainly in the second quarter, you got some benefits on a net basis. Sounds like in the second half, restructuring expense goes up, maybe offset by lower industrial tax rate. Is that the way to think about that?
I think there's a couple factors for the second half that, you know, you'd have to think about. I think, you know, there are some potential tax settlements. We would not anticipate they would fall through. You know, if you look at the strength in G Capital, I think that the G Capital team is going to continue to look at opportunities to make sure they continue to improve their earnings profile as we go forward. I don't have a specific cents per share in mind here, but, you know, we do have some projects that we're working on that we think can continue to lower the cost structure. I think if you look at the benefits from the restructuring that we've done, they're really coming through. You can see them in margins, you can see them in our variable margins, and you can see them in our base cost productivity this year. So, you know, I hope that we can do some more restructuring in the second half, and the teams are loading up some projects that we think will lower our cost structure and improve the profitability as we go forward.
So, Keith, for the year, you know, is it expense is pretty similar to the savings? Or are you net still?
The expense will be less than the savings from the, you know, the last couple of years. We did so much restructuring,
yep.
Terry. We did several billion dollars after tax. And we're not going to approach that level this year.
And then next year, the scope, you know, assuming the world doesn't fall apart on us again, would be continued savings in excess of expense?
Yes, it would.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Yep.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Steven Winoker from Sanford Bernstein.
Good morning.
Hey, Steven.
Jeff, can we just start off with capital allocation? Could you just give us a sense of prioritization across dividends, repurchases, and M&A in terms of how your thinking has continued to evolve with changing world events?
You know, I think, you know, the first thing I'd say, Steven, is that we really have, in many ways, we've executed extremely strongly on the balance sheet and cash availability. I think, you know, the numbers we show you today are all at or above their, you know, kind of the baseline. And, you know, we still have the NBCU transaction and stuff like that out there. So with that as an outset, I'll just kind of track through. You know, I think when you think about the dividend, you know, I think it's important for the board and me as we see capital losses have peaked, pre-tax earnings accelerating, the regulatory capital standards clarified. I think it gives us confidence as we go through that on the dividend, and you know, that's more or less these things were all kind of falling in place, and so. You know, we want it to be safe, but we also want to be investor friendly when we think about that. And these are things the board and I will talk through. I think as you get past that, you know, you think about buybacks, and then I think it depends on alternatives. If we get good complementary acquisitions are available at the right value, we'd look to deploy our capital there. But if our stock were valued similarly to where it is today, then you know, doing a buyback is something that's a good alternative. And so I think the dividend is easier to focus in on, and then buyback versus acquisitions just really all depends on returns and availability and things like that. And we've got, you know, look, when we look at our financial profile, you know, we think that's from underlying operations, and the financial flexibility is just the way to make the company even stronger. So that's how I would view the pluses and minuses on capital allocation.
Right, and clearly there's been some price moves within oil and gas and other sectors that you have talked about as kind of priority areas over time, right?
Look, we still think the company is going to do M&A. You know, in infrastructure, in the right size range, and we have the cash available to do that. You know, look, I think having, you know, just think about it. You've got something like $60 billion of cash in GE Capital. You're going to have by the end of the year $25 billion of cash at the parent. You know, we've seen GE Capital really strengthen. Pre-tax is growing. Losses seem to have peaked. Keith talked about the fact that essentially we think that GE Capital is going to, you know, be able to shrink and grow earnings into whatever capital structure it needs to have. So that gives us tremendous freedom. The income maintenance agreement, you know, look, we'll see what the second half says, but if you just took the first half and multiplied it by two, there's no income maintenance agreement that GE Capital is needed. But we'll see how that all goes as time goes on. I just think it ought to give investors a heck of a lot of confidence in the capital allocation options available to the leadership of the company.
Okay, and you mentioned cash flow. Just, Keith, maybe so I get a better idea. I mean, industrial cash flow on operating assets was down 10%. I know you talked about you know, progress collections, again, being offset by working capital improvements, but even relative to revenue, are there any other negatives that are going on there that we should be aware of?
The only dynamic I have is that the progress is down, and we've offset that with receivables and inventory and accounts payable. I'm not aware.
And CapEx. Okay. All right. And then I guess on the organic growth number, could you just give us, last quarter was down 6%. What was it this year, this quarter for industrial?
Yeah. Organic revenue for industrial was down 4%.
Okay. Great. And then the final thing is that on the orders front, you know, they were up 17%, but if you, depending on how you treated the Iraqi order, obviously it might be, I guess, 3% if you thought about that being Q1 versus Q2 or somewhere in between. Again, the progression of orders within the quarter, was that rising or falling across the infrastructure businesses?
I think better. I think if you look at energy, even ex-Iraq positive, you look at oil and gas, very positive. On equipment, you look at healthcare positive, you look at transportation, some big orders. You know, I think aviation's down. I, you know, I, the the reality is that the airframers are pretty full through 11 and 12. Now, we do have some encouraging signs. You know, you saw that Boeing has said that they're going to increase the 777 from 5 to 7 a month in mid-11. Eventually, that's going to impact us on orders on equipment. Airbus is going to take the A320 from 34 to 36 at the end of this year. Boeing's going to take the 737 from 31.5 to 35 a month in 2012. I mean, those will start to flow through in equipment orders again, but we had such a big backlog. That's the one that I think is just a little slow and will stay there a little bit. But the others, I think, are encouraging. You know, it's a lumpy, long cycle orders are lumpy, but it's encouraging.
I think, Stephen, you said it right. I think, you know, looking at the timing of Iraq and stripping that out, you know, thinking about orders going forward in the single digit-ish type range is the right way to think about it.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Stephen.
Your next question comes from the line of Bob Cornell from Barclays Capital.
Hey, guys. Yeah, you covered a lot of ground. The corporate expense was a little less than I would have thought in my model. You talked about restructuring ramping up in the second half. Can you give us a guide for what corporate expense is likely to be for the full year and how that might trend over the balance of the year?
You know, I can tell you what it is in the quarter. I think in the quarter, you know, we're down a couple hundred million, Bob. You go from 500 of cost to 300 if you see that on the income statement schedule that we put out.
Right.
The segment schedule. Basically, that's lower restructuring, partially offset by higher pension. And then we had the gain that I mentioned in environmental gave you a little bit of a decline there. I think if you normalize that, the pension continues at the normal level, the higher level. It's on track to be a billion pre-tax higher ex restructuring for the year. We'll have to see on restructuring. I think restructuring is the flexibility we have in the second quarter. In the second half, in the second quarter, there's about a penny after tax. That could be higher as we go into the second half of the year in the corporate line. And I don't anticipate anything like another environmental settlement. This was a long old case that just settled in the second quarter. So I don't think you'll get that credit benefit in the corporate expenses. So I think you're probably back up closer to the 500 level on a more normalized run rate.
Well, you know, we had flat for the year. Is that too high a corporate expense number for this year based on what you see now?
I don't know how to compare to your model, Bob. I think I'll ask Trevor to take a look at it with you.
Cool.
Okay.
The other question is, it sounds like in tech that, you know, the service numbers were all a little bit lighter than you would have thought. I mean, you could just comment there a little bit quickly.
Sure. The place that we're seeing an impact, obviously, is in aviation. It is a little lighter than we thought. The number of overhauls in the quarter was 279. That was down basically 80 overhauls from last year. And it's driven by CFM. You know, we're seeing a lot of airlines. They're under cost pressure. They're pushing out service, doing bare minimum of service. I think we had some impact from the lower flying hours in April from the volcano. But now you're seeing growth in revenue passenger miles. You're seeing growth in freight passenger miles. It seems like there's a three-month lag between the revenue passenger miles rolling into kind of more overhaul activity and maybe as much as six-month lag between the freight passenger miles growing into overhaul activity. But with both of those very positive in the first half, you know, that should be better. Sequentially, we're looking at overhauls of about 330 in the third quarter. That should be up about 10%. But it's still that's sequentially up, but it's still down versus last year about 6%. So, I think the good news is in front of us, but I think it's just going to be a little slow to materialize. And on a comparison to last year, it's still a little tough.
Okay, I thought you're pressed for time. I'll pass the baton. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Your next question comes from the line of Chris Glynn from Oppenheimer.
Thanks. Just
Chris.
Hi. Good. Just digging into the orders a little bit, the comment on single-digit growth in the second half. It's kind of interesting with the tough fourth quarter comp. Just wondering what's driving that strength in particular in the verticals.
You know, I would say there's always a fourth quarter ramp in businesses like healthcare and energy and stuff like that, Chris. So, you know, I think when we look at our funnels across the businesses, and you think about businesses like transportation that are coming off a very low base, you know, that's really what we base it on. So, again, like I said, it's difficult to forecast. It's difficult to predict. It tends to be lumpy. But when we sit down, when I sit down and, you know, visit with our commercial leaders, this is kind of the roll-up that I look at.
Okay, and one follow-up. NBC. Oh, sorry.
Look at energy through the first half. You know, it's a little lumpy on even something like Iraq. Through the first half, the total energy is, you know, basically down one. I think on a normalized basis, that's probably better instead of worrying about the lumpiness of Iraq. Is it in or is it out? That's a pretty, you know, to get to flat and maybe up slightly in the second half is something the teams are working on.
Okay, and then just on NBCU, I think if we back up the impairment last year, profits were actually down a little bit. Is everything going all right there with the margins and any restructuring benefits? Was a little surprised by that.
I don't have anything that we're comparing to last year that gave them a positive V here. I think they had very few other income items in the quarter, transactions this year or last year. Whatever they had was the same as last year in my analysis, Chris.
Okay, I must have misplaced something.
The third
Thank
quarter,
you.
In the third quarter they do quarter. Have a yeah. they did have a gain from the A&E.
Yeah.
Got it. Thanks.
Yep.
Your next question comes from the line of Steve Tusa from J.P. Morgan.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
So GE Capital revenues were basically flat, but, you know, the assets were down dramatically. You know, you guys are really had a plan there, doing well on the cash conversion. And you talked about your contributed value margin being 5.3% versus 5%. Where does that contributed value margin get better, or are you starting to already see degradation there? You know, how does the second half look? Because I know your guidance for the year is 5% on margin. Then just to follow on to that is, was there anything in the quarter in GE Capital revenues that was kind of unusual that needs to be stripped out?
You know, I don't have a lot in GE Capital that needs to be stripped out. I think the margins are better. You can see that on underwriting, the margins that we're getting on new volume is very good. We're going to be rolling off some of the lower margin volume that we did in the last four years. You know, the margin contribution to growth in the second quarter was substantial. And, you know, that's not going to change dramatically as you go forward. I mean, with these high margins and the runoff and the comparisons, I think you're going to continue to get benefits from better margin in GE Capital.
So you should be able to beat that 5% this year, it sounds like.
We've given you a 5% number. In the quarter, it was 5.3. It's, you know, if it stayed at that level, that would continue to be really good as we go through the year.
Okay, and then one last question. Given the kind of dramatic facelift of the portfolio in GE Capital, focused on more of the, you know, core businesses as you wind down E&I, is there reason to believe that those provisions and those reserves should be lower than historical levels kind of out in the normalized period, or are we just in kind of a different credit environment where those metrics are stubbornly high?
Sure. I think, you know, our reserves, our loss provisions are going to follow our delinquencies and non-earnings. And as those delinquencies and non-earnings continue to improve, our loss provisions are going to come down. Eventually, you're not going to have, you know, $9 billion of reserves. Some of it will come down, the majority through write-offs, but I believe that you're going to have a need for lower reserves in a normalized margin environment. And, you know, it's pretty clear to us that we think losses have peaked. If you look versus the fourth quarter of 2009, we're $900 million less on the credit provision. Even including marks and impairments, we're $600 million less than the high point. We've got two quarters of improvement. You know, I think you're just going to continue to see this book get better. Now, that's subject to what happens in the world and the economy, but I think based on the outlook we see today, that's a pretty good earnings generator for the next several years.
Steve, if I can, I would add something just to what Keith said, which is about the front end of the business. You know, we still have the best origination force in the industry. We're well positioned in the mid-market franchise. In a lot of the segments that we compete in, we have far fewer competitors today than we did pre-crisis. So I think not just from a loss standpoint is the scenario going to get better, but I also think from a origination standpoint, we're at a very good time for GE Capital.
Right, the pre-tax, pre-provisioning number actually improved quite a bit too, so clearly you're getting some good headway on the margin side. One last quick question just on the GE Aviation R&D. You talked about a couple hundred million dollars. Is that a is that a year-over-year increase every year? Is that an annual, you know, an increase from 2010 that should be sustained for the next several years? I didn't quite understand what you were saying there.
I just think there's a lot of new technology that's coming in, and you know, as I look at where we're going to go, you know, in the next few years, it's going to be in that range as a year-over-year basis. You know, again,
right. So, like, so a couple hundred million bucks a year.
So I'd say a couple hundred million up to a half a billion
per year.
In that range.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot.
But again, guys, you know, the way it's all about leadership, and it's really all about driving technology at a moment in time when we think that's of most value.
Okay. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Scott Davis from Morgan Stanley.
Hi. Thanks, guys.
Good morning, Scott.
I want to just ask a couple follow-up questions. I mean, the commercial real estate unrealized loss is a pretty nice directional move. How do you think about the model? Is that better experience in the actual properties or somewhat of a change in assumptions based on macro variables? I mean, how do you get to kind of that number?
Well, I think the number one thing that drives it down is we depreciate the properties we own. Number two, the impairments we take lower the book value. So those are the two biggest pieces. We have not factored into any changes in future rental growth or cap rates or anything to lower that amount. That's mostly coming from our performance, from our write-offs and impairments and the depreciation of the properties.
Okay.
And that will continue. You know, we depreciate a little over $1 billion a year, and obviously with the impairments in the quarter, a $500 million pre-tax, you know, that's a bite that is right into the unrealized loss.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. Jeff, I know you talked a bit about R&D, up 14% year over year, and you're trying to stimulate new products. I mean, how do you see that growth in R&D? I mean, pretty much since you've taking the job, you've had a nice focus on R&D, but up 14% is a pretty good number. I mean, when you look for 2011, 2012, kind of the out years, is there some sort of sweet spot that you hit where you don't need to kind of grow it anymore, where you have your platforms funded?
Yeah, you know, definitely, Scott. You know, I kind of peg it at kind of between 5% and 6% of the, you know, of our industrial revenue. And you know, we're going to have about 30% more products this year than in the past, and I think you see that, you know, with our market share in healthcare, and you know, as you know, this is what sets up the service revenue and all the things that come with it. So, you know, I always think that's a sweet spot that gives us a competitiveness position against all of our key competitors.
Sure. So basically growing with revenues from here or growing ahead of revenues?
Look, I'd say growing more or less with revenues from here.
Okay. And just to narrow down a little bit, you know, clearly you'll have a little bit more R&D in the aviation side. I mean, does that mean you can take a little bit from an area that doesn't have quite the growth potential?
You know, what I would say is we're going to look across the portfolio. I spike out aviation because I think they're in a particular cycle, and there might be opportunities to reallocate inside the company. But we also still see good potential for healthcare and energy and some of our other platforms as well.
Look, it's the most valuable growth we can do is if we can invest in technology to improve our organic growth, and we're committed to it. Every single one of our strategic plans that we went through this year, Scott, you know, the number one thing is what's the R&D deck to continue to improve our competitive position.
Sure.
The teams are committed to it, and I think it's a better place for the company to be at these levels of R&D spending.
Sure, agreed. Just to, again, narrowed in on it, I mean, one of the potential side effects you could argue on health imagination is maybe not as much of a focus on the arms race and the, you know, the next generation of CT
scanner type
thing.
Well, I think that's right.
What I
look at health imagination though, the share we're gaining on the lower end in places like China and India is substantial.
But that doesn't require quite as much
exactly.
R&D spend, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And lastly, Keith, just to clarify, I mean, you've the CFOA has been fantastic, and working capital has come out pretty aggressively. I mean, are we pretty close to being done with what you can do in working capital now that, you know, presumably your growth rates are bottoming out and you'll start to build backlog again?
I don't think so. We, you know, we basically, as I said, we went through the strategic plan this summer. You know, we're trying to get a goal. We have benchmarks for every one of our businesses, and the goal that we would have is probably about a half a turn of working capital improvement each year to continue to offset the growth that we have in the businesses or any pressure from progress collections. And you know, 2 years ago, we stated that as our goal, and we've been able to deliver that through the first half of all of 2009, the first half of 2010. So, you know, we have an operating council. We meet every month. The teams are focused on improving their processes. Our working capital turnover went up in the second quarter, again, a couple of tenths in receivables and inventory and accounts payable. And, you know, there's more to do here in terms of using lean and being more efficient and sharing practices across the company where we have better performance.
You know, Scott, when you look at our long-term incentive plan, one of the big drivers is cumulative cash flow from operating activities. So all of the leadership team is incented to drive working capital improvement and strong CFOA. And I think this is what you see in the execution.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Great. Thanks,
Scott.
Our next question comes from the line of Jason Feldman from UBS.
Morning.
Hey, good morning, Jason.
So you've talked a couple times now about expecting $25 billion of cash at the parent level by the end of the year. I guess I'm just kind of wondering how much you really need to keep there. I mean, at finance, you've got better capital ratios and leverage ratios than, for some time, if ever. You know, how much of a backstop do you still really need at the parent level, or how much of that can you deploy?
You know, we haven't really decided yet. On this one, you know, I would say clearly we're going to have more cash in the future than we had, you know, pre-crisis. But with $25 billion, we're going to have substantial flexibility to do the things we want to do to grow the company. I don't know, Keith, would you add to that?
Sure. I think we're obviously priority number one was to make the company safe and secure. I think we've crossed that threshold. I think you mentioned it. G Capital, we've got enough capital. We've got a lot of cash, and we've got enough cash to handle any liquidity issues there. We're looking from an enterprise risk perspective at how much capital do you need at the parent for unforeseen events, for systemic risk, and it's going to be some amount, obviously more than we used to hold. You know, we used to hold $2 billion at the parent. It's going to be more than that, but we haven't given a specific number. But even above whatever that threshold is, we're going to have substantial cash. We're going to be able to redeploy all the NBCU cash and a lot of our free cash flow from the business operations into capital activities that will improve the future value, as Jeff said.
Okay. And then last question is, you mentioned, you know, not just today but in the past, that you've got far fewer competitors in the finance business than pre-crisis. You know, at least one large bank, I think another as well, mentioned sharply higher originations in the small business lending area. Have you seen an uptick in competition as the banks have begun to recover or any change in the competitive environment?
You know, I'd say we really haven't in the spaces we're in. I mean, I think you got to remember about, you know, where GE Capital is. We're like deep in things like private label credit cards, retail, mid-market lending, aircraft leasing. You know, in the places where we are, sure, we're going to have competitors, but I think we have pretty unique scale niches, and that's it's we feel good about our dynamics.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Noelia, why don't we take one more question? We've been going for a while here.
Thank you. Your final question comes from the line of John Inch from Merrill Lynch.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, John.
Morning, guys. So the implication, I think, Jeff, you made the statement of the $25 billion still expected by year-end in cash. Does that imply that NBC is still on track to close by year-end, and I'm assuming there's some sort of dovetailing with EU approval?
You know, John, I hate to predict exactly when it's going to close, you know, just because we don't control it, but we don't see anything today that changes what we've said in the past, and so we put that in as a marker, but again, remember, we don't control it, and so I want to respect the process.
Sure.
No, I understand.
The $25 billion assumes it closes by year-end, but
yeah.
What if it pushes out a little bit? We're still going to get that capital.
Yeah.
We do believe this deal is going to close, and there is a timing question. Right now, our teams are working very constructively with both the DOJ and the FCC. You know, we filed all the information. We're in active dialogue, and the formal clocks end sometime in November. And so we're going to work like crazy to get that closed by year end. But that's tied to that assumption, obviously.
Right. And the delta is like what, about an $8 billion?
$8 billion. Yeah.
Okay. And then, Keith, the cash impact of Lake, is it materially different than what we see in terms of the charge-offs per quarter? Like, was it different than the 2 cents, and kind of what's the trend there?
Yeah, there was no cash impact yet of Lake, but ultimately the amounts we pay above the $2.2 billion will be cash paid to Shinsei for the claims. It's going to be dollar for dollar. The reserve amounts will be cash in Japan. And these are without any tax effects, so there's dollar for dollar on the reserve increases.
Okay, that makes sense. Just last question, more of a housekeeping. On the balance sheet, I think the liabilities associated with businesses held for sale seem to go up a lot sequentially, but it didn't look like the assets of the businesses held for sale were up that much. Is there something meaningful there? I think it was about $4 billion of change.
Sure. We completed the NBCU debt offering. If you remember in the quarter, we have $6 billion of term financing that we need to do before we close the deal. We did $4 billion of that.
Okay.
In the second quarter, a very successful offering. So that's what that is.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for your time and questions today. Just to close out, the replay of today's webcast will be available this afternoon, and I have a few housekeeping items to close out here. First, we will be distributing our quarterly supplemental data schedule for GE Capital later today. In the past, we've issued this in conjunction with our 10-Q, so we wanted to get the data in your hands sooner. Second, we have our analyst meeting at the Farnborough Air and Show next week on July 20th, and please visit our website for details there. Third, we'll be scheduling a GE Capital webcast for later this year. You know, we've had several of our leaders, including Mike Neal, added to sell-side conferences, so we haven't done a webcast, but we'll still be doing one later this year, so we'll send out details once that's finalized. Finally, our third quarter 2010 earnings webcast will take place on Friday, October 15th, and as always, Joanne and I are here to take questions and go through anything you have. Thanks, everyone.